Chapter 13. Plants Charged to Frank. About the middle of June, both sides commenced making preparations for Frank's trial, and it was even then a safe guess that it would be the South's greatest legal battle. Solicitor General Dorsey announced that he had retained Frank A. Hooper to assist him in the prosecution. Felder had dropped out of the case after the dictograph incident. Hooper was a recent comer to Atlanta and had never been pitted against the city big lawyers. However, he was for 12 years the solicitor of the Southwestern Circuit and had made quite a reputation. Dorsey's ability had been recognized a year before when he prosecuted Mrs. Daisy Grace, who was defended by John W. Moore and by Rosser. Although he lost the case, he handled it in a masterly manner. Reuben R. Arnold, probably the South's greatest criminal lawyer, was retained to assist in the defense. It is said that his fee was $12,500. Rosser remained as leading counsel and is alleged to have received a fee of $15,000. The trial was originally set on the Superior Court calendar for June 30th, but on June 24th, Judge L. S. Roan called the attorneys before him and frankly told them that he had promised to go to the seashore with Mrs. Roan during the first week in July, and suggested postponing the case. Both sides said they were ready, although they were not, but agreed, after some discussion, to a postponement, and the date of July 28th was fixed for the trial. The defense, by this time, had let it be known that its theory of the case was that Connolly had killed the girl on the first floor and chucked her down the scuttle hole. To bear out this theory, a more or less important discovery is alleged to have been made. On May the 10th, L.P. McWorth and a man named Whitefield, both Pinkerton operatives who have since been discharged, were making a search of the factory. On the first floor, near the point Jim Connolly claims he sat and waited for Frank's call, they found the corner of a pay envelope bearing the name Mary Fagan and the parts of two numerals. Also, they found a bludgeon with stains which looked like blood on it. Near the scuttle hole, alleged blood stains had been found before, and near the point where the part of a payslip was found were several pieces of twine, knotted just like those found around Mary Fagan's neck. The finds were made during the absence from the city of Harry Scott, field chief of the Pinkertons, during the investigation. Reports were made at once to the defense, but not a word was said about the matter to the city police, to whom the Pinkertons had faithfully promised to make reports before they made them to the defense. On the return of Scott to the city, he learned that the pay envelope, but nothing more, had been found, and he immediately informed the city police. The fact did not become public for some weeks, but when it was learned that the envelope had been found, Chief Lanford dismissed it with the cry, "Plant," declaring that his men had searched the factory from top to bottom and would have found it had it been in the place the first few days after Mary Fagan was murdered. The place had been thoroughly cleaned, in addition, he said, by the factory officials. A week or two after the part of a pay envelope was found, fingerprint experts examined it, but after they had used all known methods, announced that they were unable to find any trace of a fingerprint on it. It was several weeks later that it became known that the bludgeon was also discovered near the place where Connolly admitted lying in wait. Chief Lanford declared that he was in ignorance of the discovery of the bludgeon, but it was also dismissed as a plant. Lanford severely criticized H.B. Pierce, superintendent of the Pinkerton Agency, for not acquainting the city officials of the alleged find. Before the trial commenced, Pierce had left the city, and the Pinkertons have now discharged him. The assertions of the city detectives that the evidence was being planted caused another wave of sentiment against Frank. There was one other development of importance before the trial. W. H. Mincy, an insurance agent and schoolteacher, made an affidavit to the defense that on Saturday, April 26, Conley confessed to him that he had murdered a girl that morning. Mincy asserted that late in the afternoon he was at the corner of Electric Avenue and Carter Streets, near the home of Conley, when he approached the black, asking that he take an insurance policy. The Negro told him, he said, to go along, that he was in trouble. Asked what his trouble was, Mincy swore that Conley replied he had killed a girl. "You are Jack the Ripper, are you?" said Mincy. "No," he says, Conley replied, "I killed a white girl. You better go along or I will kill you." After some words, Mincy says he left the belligerent Negro. The substance of Conley's affidavit became public only a short time before the trial commenced, and while Mincy was teaching school at Rising Fawn in North Georgia. Chief Lanford remembered that Mincy had called at police headquarters while Conley was making one of his sensational statements and asked to see him on the pretext that he wanted to identify a drunken Negro he had seen the Saturday of the tragedy. He made no intimation then, the chief asserts, of a confession, and after looking at Conley, said that he could not identify him. It suffices to say that Mincy, although brought to Atlanta on a subpoena, was never called upon by the defense to take the witness stand. It is said that Dorsey was loaded for him and had 25 witnesses who would try to impeach him. Mincy, it is said, has written several books on mind reading, and the solicitor had copies of the books ready to use them in his cross-examination. The general value of expert testimony is shown by an incident of the case. Jim Conley had never admitted writing but one of the notes, so the solicitor continued to have both of them examined by experts. 6 so-called experts were ready to go on the witness stand and swear that Frank, not Conley, had written both notes. Finally, in desperation, Dorsey took them to New York, where one of the country's best-known experts declared that Jim Conley wrote both of them. On his return, the solicitor forced the confession from the Negro that he did write both notes.